small stone. Shall I? I'm gonna make small stones.
12 one way, a dozen the other, I don't know. They told me Kino, but I'll quick Q&A is fine. I'll do whatever you want me to do.
Mr. Ranson, if you could ask people to...
I don't know if that's good. You can plug in the car. Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's okay, sir.
Okay, guys. So, we have a great opportunity and privilege to have with us Rabbi Branowitz, who's one of the deans, one of the Rosh Yeshivas of this Yeshivah. Rabbi Branowitz joined here
6 years ago. Yeah.
6 years ago, from the United States, where he was the Rav of a congregation, and he was also a professor of law. He really has a tremendous amount of knowledge of not just the classic sources, but also contemporary issues. He's really in touch with the developments in science, in law, and different issues. And please use this opportunity to ask things that bother you, things that you want clarification with, because he's really a tremendous source of not just knowledge and inspiration as well. Thank you so much for giving up from your time.
Thank you.
And you're right away.
Thank you. I do want to welcome all of you, and it's a pleasure to have you, an honor to have you. And I know that, like the airlines say, there are a lot of different things you could have done with your time. And the fact that you came to Eretz Yisrael to learn Torah and to try to understand the nature of what it means to be Jewish is really a great, great tribute to you. And as I say, and all of us say here, you basically inspire us at least as much as, and perhaps more than we inspire you. So feel free to ask whatever you want. I do not claim I can answer any question that you ask, but feel free to ask any question that you want to ask, and we'll see if together we can get some insight or understanding. Yeah.
Meaning of life.
I don't want to just simple questions like that. No, that's so simple. Well, basically like this. I mean, we do have an answer to that. And in fact, one of the classic books, the Mesilas Yesharim, written by Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzatto, actually says that the very first issue a person has to know is, why am I in this world? Why am I alive? Why did God put me here? And that posits that our goal in life is to perfect our natures by living in accordance with God's will. Now, what is God's will? That we have to spend a lifetime to study. But every human being has a mission. You have a purpose. And we don't know automatically what that purpose is. We live within a framework of mitzvot and commandments, but that's only the framework. That's not the ultimate purpose. There is a unique purpose that hopefully we discover in the course of our existence. So the purpose of our life is not to make money, and the purpose of our life is not just to have a good time. The purpose of our life is to perfect our soul and bring it closer to God. You know, they tell a little story about an obsessive compulsive individual who needed to be fully prepared for every event. And when he was taking his first trip to Israel, in those days there were no direct flights, so there was a 7-hour stopover in France. He spent the year before the trip learning French, so for those 7 hours he would be 100% prepared. And that was great. He ordered a Coca-Cola like a native. But after 7 hours, he had to get back on the plane, and he realized with a sickening sense of foreboding that he was so busy learning French, he didn't bother to learn any Hebrew. He was focusing on the stopover and not on the ultimate destination. Well, that's relatively trivial. But in many, many ways, this life is only a stopover. There is an ultimate destination after 120 years, we hope, in which we stand before God and we give an accounting of how we lived our lives. And in those days, when that happens, it really makes no difference how many deals we pulled off, how much money we made. The only thing that matters is, what goodness did we do? How did we treat our wife and children? Were we people of compassion or people of resentment? That's all that happens. So it's true that in the 120 years of stopovers in this world, we got to learn all sorts of skills. You know, a profession, an occupation, either driving or how to use public transportation. And these are things we got to do. But anybody who focuses on the stopover skills is as short-sighted and tragically more short-sighted than the individual who only learned French and didn't bother to learn Hebrew. So, you know, people say, well, I am so busy, I have so many things to do in my life. When I get older, when I graduate school, that's when I'll explore the meaning of life. Well, trust me, you've got much more time now that you're going to have later. That even though I know that college is a busy time, I mean, I was there myself, I'm aware of that, but still, precisely when you're single, you're unattached, you're a student, you're not yet in the working world, this is really the time to explore what it is that we're living for. Because I will tell you, you know, I'm an older person by now, I'm getting old, that all of our lives, we always have a new goal, right? When you're, you know, in grammar school, you want to get to a good high school, get into good college, want to get high grades, and you enter, my background is law, so I'm more familiar with law, you enter a law firm and you become partner, and there's always the next goal, the next ring, brass ring to look forward to. But at some point, you're going to go as high as you can make it in this world. You know you're not going to be, again, forgive me for American analogies, you're not going to be President of the United States or Prime Minister of England. You're not going to win the Olympics. You're not going to be on the Supreme Court. You're going to go as high as you're going to go. Maybe that'll hit you at 35, maybe at 45, maybe at 50. You're going to hit a ceiling. And then you have to ask yourself, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks, what is the purpose of the rest of my life? And call that, you know, middle age burnout, whatever you want to call it. But it's going to hit you. It doesn't hit you when you're young because you still have those short-term goals to aspire to. It is going to hit you when you're old. And there'll be a lot of malaise unless you give some thought and some investment into the meaning of life. Yeah?
So this has got a three-part question.
Yes.
So according to Jewish law, is it okay to make aliyah? Is it okay
make what?
To make aliyah?
Yes.
Is it okay to live in a Jewish state in modern times? And also, is it okay to have a state before the Moshiach comes?
Okay, well, question two and three. Oh, okay, those are very, very excellent questions, and I'm glad that you separated them, because to some degree they are separate questions. Issue number one is it okay to make aliyah, which simply means, is it okay, is it proper, is it mandatory, is it prohibited, I imagine you're asking, to live in Israel? absolutely, it is certainly okay. And this is even true for those who are against the state of Israel. There is a big, big argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides, two of the greatest scholars. According to Nachmanides, it is a mitzvah, it is mandatory to live in the land of Israel. According to Maimonides, it is not mandatory, but it's still a wonderful, great thing. So there is no question that living in the land of Israel is a spiritually elevating experience, which according to some views is a mitzvah, according to another view it's a great thing. Now, does that mean everybody has to live in Israel? Does that mean that nobody's allowed to live outside? Well, there are dispensations for living outside. If it's difficult to make a living, if you need to find a wife, if you need to find a better rabbi or yeshiva that for some reason you don't find here, although that's increasingly a weaker argument, there are dispensations, but you have to have it on the radar. For a person not even to think about living in Israel is an abdication of responsibility, even if you eventually come out that it's not the right time for you. It has to be in your mind. Now, the second and third question, though, is very, very important. Even if living in the land of Israel is a great, great mitzvah, is it proper for there to be a Jewish state before the coming of Mashiach? Now here, as you probably know, and indeed in England, the Neturei Karta is very strong, there is a fundamental debate. There were many sages that take the position that it is forbidden for the Jewish people to create an independent Jewish polity until the coming of the Mashiach. And the extremists who believe that actually take the position that you should dismantle the Jewish state and turn it over to the Arabs. Now, I think that's absolutely crazy, but their belief is that if somehow we would abandon nationalism and Zionism, the Arabs would love us and there would be peace and the like. Well, think about ISIS. I'm not sure ISIS would go along with that. The vast majority of religious Torah Jews do not accept that position, and they do say that it is proper for the Jewish people to create a haven. Now, they disagree with many policies of the state. They're not, they're in opposition to sometimes the state makes anti-religious decisions. That's a separate issue. But nonetheless, the concept that Jews should have a state of their own even before the Mashiach is considered to be proper by most segments. Not all segments, but by most segments of Am Yisrael. If you go to Mea Sharim, the great, great holy neighborhood of Mea Sharim, where there are many, many righteous and great people, many of them are against the idea of the State of Israel, but as I say, they are largely in a minority position. Yeah?
Who is God and where did he come from?
I didn't hear you say again?
Who is God?
Who is God? Yeah.
Where did he come from?
Well, God didn't come from anywhere because everything comes from God. God is the source. And Judaism very much believes, this is our fundamental principle of faith, that God was not created, God just was. And we don't understand that. We don't understand the concept of infinite time. That's something that we can say the words. We don't really understand it. The nature of God is also something we can't understand. Maimonides says the following. Maimonides writes, and he was a great philosopher as well as a halachic scholar and a physician. Maimonides writes, this is called in philosophy the doctrine of negative attributes. You can only describe God by negation, not by affirmation. So I can say what God is not. God is not whatever I am. God is not a body. God does not have multiplicity. God does not have finiteness. God does not have physicality. I can negate that because these are characteristics I can identify within myself and say that God does not have those things. To say what God is, in many ways, is beyond our comprehension. Now, he is described both by the Torah and in the oral law as having compassion, love, and the like. But even there, Maimonides warns us that we are not necessarily describing internal psychological states. We are simply describing behaviors, that God's behaviors are generally indicative of love and compassion. We're not describing God, we are describing behavioral attributes of God. So, the short answer to your question is a famous remark by Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Gabaral, one of the great, great philosophers of the Middle Ages, where he said, if I would understand God, I would be He. In other words, only God can understand God. And, you know, your question is vast, and I can throw out a million questions. Maybe you're going to raise these questions. For example, God, because God is infinite, He transcends all dichotomies and self-contradictions. So, for example, one of the classic issues in Jewish philosophy is, if God knows the future, God knows what I'm going to do tomorrow, God knows what I was going to do 1,000 years ago, 1,000,000 years ago, then how can it be said when I wake up in the morning I have free will? How do you reconcile the idea of autonomy of choice if God already knows my choice, so in effect it's been taken away from me? If God knew 1,000,000 years ago that I would daven Thursday morning, then how could it be said that when I wake up Thursday morning I have the choice not to daven? Right? I'm not answering that question, but the example would be that God transcends the logical alternatives because He incorporates everything. So it's really an unanswerable question. Very good question. Yeah.
Really interesting study in the Way of God. He says that God created this earth. God created the world to study His pleasure. All
yes.
Good.
Yes.
And why would God create animals such as like poisonous, like snakes, spiders, that can kill us, when the idea would be that He's meant to bestow pleasure on the earth?
Yeah, well, it's a very excellent question. As you know, the Derech Hashem was actually written by Rav Moshe Chaim Lusato, who was a great philosopher and Kabbalist as well. He goes further and he develops, well, if God created the world to bestow pleasure, then why is there suffering, right? Why is there struggle? And his thesis is that if we were to get pleasure without struggle, the pleasure would not be complete because we didn't earn it. So all of the difficulties we have in life are the mechanisms of which we struggle, and we have to fight the wars of the Yetzer Hara. We even have to fight against diseases, because then when we emerge victorious, we have achieved something, and therefore the joy of receiving God's reward is a true joy. So in that sense, your question about the poisonous snake is very similar to why there was a Holocaust, and why is there AIDS, and why are there plagues. All of this is part of the struggle through which we become spiritually greater, and then we earn God's reward. I would also say, too, that there is a teaching that even that which is potentially destructive does have beneficial uses. Now, you're in your very particular example, snake venom actually has medicinal uses, and it's promoted for health benefits as well, putting aside the kashrus problem. So the truth of the matter is that things that on their surface appear to be negative and destructive may actually have positive benefits. And you know, the ecological balance in God's creation is so delicate. Let's imagine that you were to decide, and you had the power, to eliminate poisonous snakes. Because you might say, oh, who needs poisonous snakes? All they do are poison, right? Well, you would be quite shocked, I think, at how that would disturb the ecological balance. Perhaps because there are no poisonous snakes, you would have super big rats that would mutate and destroy the world, right? So the snakes can poison you, but they also poison other dangerous predators. So on balance, God created a checks and balance system, which is so intricate that you can never fool around with it. You try to change any little thing, and you never know what the consequences are. Yeah?
As far as I'm aware, there are certain things which have to happen in order for Mashiach to come.
Yeah.
Can you give slightly detail of what needs to happen and what?
Well, you know, it is hard to be very specific. Again, I go with Maimonides, who is such a source on so many things. In the Tanakh and in the writings of the sages, there is a description of great apocalyptic upheavals that will happen before the coming of Mashiach. Now, and that is called in Tanakh the wars of Gog and Magog, which are unidentified nations. The Christian word, Armageddon, is really the Greek contraction of Gog. I don't know how you get it exactly, but Gog Magog is read Armageddon. So that's so what the Christians talk about is something that comes from our tradition. Now, there's a big question. Did that happen already? We hope it did, because if it didn't, we're in for something worse. Perhaps that was World War II. Perhaps it was the Cold War. Perhaps it was the Arab-Israeli conflicts. You know, we're not sure. Or perhaps it could be something we haven't had yet, which... Now, there is a statement in the writings of the Vilna Gaon, which 250 years ago made no sense at all, but now we know exactly what it means, and it's very frightening. He says, Armageddon, Gog and Magog, will only be 9 minutes long. Now, if somebody read that 250 years ago, they would say, what on earth can be a war that only lasts 9 minutes? That makes no sense. But you know, now it does make sense. God forbid it could be some type of nuclear holocaust, which the world is not so far away from when you talk about terrorist rogue nations getting a hold of nuclear weapons. So that's one idea. There'll be these struggles of Gog and Magog, and we don't know exactly what that is. Maimonides says we will know it only in retrospect, meaning when Mashiach comes, we'll be able to identify. Now, there is another point that's very important, that's more in the positive, and you guys are helping bring Mashiach, because it says, before the Mashiach comes, there will be a movement of the Jewish people to come back to God. They will return to the land of Israel. They will return to the Torah. And that will be a precursor. This is the opposite of the idea, no state until Mashiach. This expresses the idea that creating a Jewish state and bringing Jews back is what brings the Mashiach. And Baruch Hashem, that part I think, we're very far from there yet, but Baruch Hashem, I think we've seen so many Jews coming back to God, so many Jews coming back to Israel. In fact, it was the great Rav Kook's idea that even Jews who come back to Israel who were not religious, like many of the founding Zionists, they were bringing Mashiach closer by their connection to the land of Israel themselves. There is a third, so we talk about the apocalyptic wars, we talk about the return of the Jewish people to God, and the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, including building up the land of Israel. There is a third sign that the Talmud identifies, and that is the land of Israel itself will begin to flourish and produce when as we come closer to the redemption. And this is pretty amazing, because you know, all of the hundreds of years, almost 2,000 years, that very few Jews were in Israel, there were always populations here. There were Arabs or other groups. And the land was like a desert. It just didn't produce anything. Mark Twain, the great American writer, who came to Palestine, as it was called, in the 19th century, wrote about a country that was desolate, that was empty, that was desert. Nothing could grow here. The soil was acidic and rocky. And lo and behold, the Jews come back, and you go, particularly up north, Yerushalayim is not particularly fertile even now, but you go up north and you see all sorts of fruits and vegetables and fields. Now it's Shemitah, now it's a little less, but God will bless us. And the question is, if for thousands of years nobody could make anything grow here, why is the land so fertile now? So you could say, well, Jews are smart, Israeli ingenuity, high technology, all of that has some truth. But the Talmud says specifically, the land of Israel is like a mother who, when her children come home, goes crazy cooking for them. Maybe you had that experience. Mom always wants to cook for her kids. So the land of Israel withholds its bounty for the strangers. But when the Jews come back and redemption is approaching, the land becomes very fertile. So the three basic signs, the negative one is the apocalyptic tensions of Armageddon. And again, this could be Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism, it could be a whole bunch of things. The return of Jews to their tradition, and the return of Jews to the land of Israel. And finally, the agricultural flourishing of the land of Israel. So Baruch Hashem, even on the difficult side, many of the signs of the Mashiach are still here. Yeah.
Yeah, is that
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I have to get some people on this side. Yeah, I'll get back. Yeah. Are there Jews on other planets? Yeah, I guess you first have to ask: Is there life on other planets? Is the first question. That's a very, very excellent question. The few people that have written about it, there isn't a tremendous amount of writing about it, have basically said that the general approach to Judaism is that we regard this world, even though it's infinitesimally small in the whole universe, we are less than a dot, we are basically invisible compared to the size of the universe, but it is precisely this teeny weensy little world that is the purpose of God's whole edifice. And therefore, it would appear that we would, again, the mainstream view is, we would not accept the concept of other Jews or other people with a Torah and the like. Now, on the other hand, if you look in Maimonides and the like, they do talk about intelligent life within planets and stars, but that is understood in the nature of angels, meaning they don't have free will. They simply fulfill their function, but there may be some elements of consciousness. So it's very, very interesting that there may be spiritual consciousness in other worlds, but there would not be a free will with an alternative Torah. Now this I would define as the relative mainstream position. On the other hand, I have seen other views that posit that although the Torah is the perfect blueprint for this world and for this human race, there might be alternative universes that are living under different spiritual laws. So I would have to say it is an open question, but the mainstream seems to suggest that the only entity that has free, autonomous will would be the human race in this planet. Yeah?
Would you say it's unfair on non-Jews that they won't receive as higher afterlife than Jews?
Yeah, it is a good question. Again, let me remind you, and I think in your question you know this already, but just to be sure everyone knows this, Maimonides does write, again from the Talmud, that number one, a non-Jew does not have to become Jewish to have salvation. That is a unique teaching of Judaism. We do not proselytize. We do not encourage people to become Jewish. In fact, if they want to become Jewish, we even discourage them initially. And Maimonides says, as a halachic ruling, that a righteous non-Jewish person who keeps the 7 Noahide laws, those are the basic commandments of humanity, has a share in the world to come, will be connected to God. And the fact that he didn't keep the Shabbos or the Kashrut is not a problem, because he's not supposed to keep Shabbos and Kashrut. His mission is a different mission. So number one, although this is not an answer to your question, I just want to point out that to state that a non-Jew will get a share in the world to come is a lot better than either Christianity or Islam that says that if you're a non-believer in Jesus or in Muhammad, you are condemned to eternal damnation. We precisely do not say that. We do say there is a share in the world to come. Now, will a Jew get a greater share in the world to come? I think it really depends. One way of looking at this I'm going to give you a very simplistic analogy, is that imagine spiritual potentiality as a gas tank. So some cars have 16-gallon tanks, and some cars have 8-gallon tanks. The potentiality of a Jewish soul for closeness to God is greater than that of a non-Jewish soul. A Jew has a 16-gallon tank, a non-Jew has an 8-gallon tank. But consider this analogy. I can have an 8-gallon tank, which contains 6 gallons, and somebody else can have a 16-gallon tank that only contains 1 gallon. So the 8-gallon tank has more fuel in it than the 16-gallon. Where I'm going with this is this. Although it is true that every Jew, by definition, has a greater spiritual potential than a non-Jew, it could very well be the case that a given non-Jew might get more Olam Haba than a Jew, because they have filled their tank to a greater degree. So in that sense, at least that doesn't completely obliterate the distinction, but in a sense that I think at least reduces the discrimination, that non-Jews have a chance. Now, another way of answering it, or addressing it, is to ask, why aren't non-Jews treated the same way as Jews? You could ask the same question, although I know this may sound a little offensive, but the Kuzari says, you could ask the same question, is it fair that dogs are dogs, or cows are cows? You know, why didn't God make the cow into a human being? By definition, we do live in a world, a universe of hierarchy and structure, and this is part of the hierarchy. You know, to ask, you know, why can't the non-Jew? Well, first of all, the non-Jew can become a Jew if he wants, right? So the option is open. If he doesn't take the option, that is kind of the hierarchical structure. But it is important to know that chosenness does have a great responsibility. Because if a Jew commits sins and violations, God will hold him more accountable than a Gentile. So in a sense, there's a double standard. Greater reward, but greater punishment and accountability if you don't live up to that standard. So it is a mixed bag in that sense. And most importantly, however, the avenue is open to anyone who wants to embrace it. If you're a non-Jew and you want to embrace the responsibilities, you will be entitled to the reward.
During creation, it says that animals just appear in the water. How is that scientifically possible?
Well, why do you think there's a scientific problem?
Because it says that all animals just came from nowhere. That obviously, I understand you've got like krill and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The big one, how species.
Well, again, if you look at the again, I'm not at all saying the Torah endorses evolution. It may not, and it probably does not. But if you look, for example, at the evolutionary description of life, you actually see that organic life did emerge from what they call the primordial soup, right? So there actually were liquids, water, nutrients, carbon, etc., and they combined. So even if one does not accept, the gradual evolution of things, the notion that organic life arises from that liquid medium. See, water doesn't have to just be H2O. It can include all sorts of nutrients and the like. Is actually, I think, fairly consistent with the scientific picture. And therefore, the Torah is indeed consistent. Now, I do want to point out just a preliminary thought that's very, very important. And I imagine you'll probably hear much longer lectures on this. I'm not going to give you a whole lecture on it. And that is, people often ask about conflicts between Torah and science. And these are good questions, and they should be addressed. But I would suggest maybe a meta answer, meaning a very general answer to look at. And that is, in a sense, Torah and science are addressing two different areas of reality. And therefore, they don't have to be in contradiction, because Torah is addressing apples, so to speak, and science is addressing oranges, and they are not in direct conflict. Science is attempting to describe what happened, the what's of the universe. But no matter what your scientific theory is, whether it's evolution, Big Bang, whatever you want to call it, punctuated equilibrium, science cannot answer why it happens. Science has no answer to why, and if you ask any scientist, why did this process happen? Why did it start? Why was there a Big Bang? An honest scientist will tell you that is not a scientific question. Science is describing the what and not the why. Judaism, on the other hand, is less concerned with how and what God created as it is with why. What is the purpose of existence? So the Torah is not supposed to be read as a strictly scientific book. The Torah is to be read as the notion that there is a God, there is a purpose, creation is not random. So as a result, as great a rabbi, and again, this is something that needs a lot more time than I'm going to give it, maybe I shouldn't even mention it, but I'm going to mention it, and then you can talk to your rabbis about it and dump the problem on them to give you all the answers. And that is, when Darwin came out with the theory of evolution in the mid-19th century, Charles Darwin, so many rabbis were saying it contradicts Genesis, people say it today. Rav Shimshon Yuval Hirsch said the following. He says, he is not affirming evolution, and there are a lot of holes in it, and it can be criticized. But he said the following. Even if one were to definitively prove evolution, which to this day has not been definitively proved, he said it would not be a threat to his faith as long as we believe that God guided the process. God has an infinite number of tools in his toolbox. He could do this, he could do that, he could do that, he could do that. And the Torah is not concerned with giving you a blow-by-blow account of how God did it, as long as you believe it's not random, as long as you believe it's not chaotic, as long as you believe that it was purposeful. Now again, you're going to have to go back to the verses and see how these theories could fit. That's a difficult question. But it's not so much an article of faith. So as a result, almost any question of religion and science could be answered by this general idea that as long as you believe God is guiding the process, he could have done it this way, he could have done it this way, it doesn't really make much of a difference.
You say that the Torah doesn't prove evolution, you say that scientists only ask what, not why.
Yep.
But then Darwin's theory of evolution does state why, because they're adapting to the environment. So does the tour just suggest that
let me just explain that the big hole, the very, very big, again, and Darwin, by the way, was happened to be a religious man, by the way. Darwin actually believed in God. He was not an atheist. Later, his theories were taken in an anti-religious way. There's a tremendous hole in Darwinian evolutionary theory which has not been answered to this very day, and that is intermediate stages that have no functionality. But by that I mean the following. Again, I cannot give you all the examples off the top of my head, but Darwin's idea is that in nature there will generally be a lot of different forms, big, small, etc. And the ones that have the greatest capacity for survival are going to survive. And then all incremental changes are based on survival of the fittest. Now, how you get from a fish to an ape, that itself is a mystery, but his theory is, over a long enough time, incremental changes will produce species changes. Number one, that's a big question in and of itself. But here's the other problem. The problem is that a lot of incremental changes, if you go between A and Z, right, you have B to Y, are of no advantage to survival. It's only the end result. So why do you get those intermediate middle stages is the biggest kasha, so to speak, on Darwin, because there are many, numerous intermediate stages that have no survival advantage. Now, if you understand that God is guiding the process, so God could guide the process, but if it's a simple mechanical survival of the fittest, that does not fit all of the models. Yeah?
So I understand that way from
okay, this is an excellent question, and I need to correct it a little bit, because what you're saying is a very good question. During biblical times, the Jewish people were divided into two monarchies, two kingdoms. The southern kingdom, which had Jerusalem and the temple, was called the Kingdom of Yehuda. And in that southern tribe was the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe of Benjamin, Binyamin, and the Kohanim and Levim. And then we had the northern kingdom, which was the kingdom of the 10 tribes. Sometimes our kingdoms were at war with each other, Jew against Jew. Other times they lived in peace, but they were two different groups. The northern kingdom of the 10 tribes were destroyed and exiled more than 100 years before the destruction of the temple. And they never got reunited, and hence we have the stories called the Lost 10 Tribes, which to this day have not been united with us. Some say, some claim the Ethiopian Jews are remnants of the Lost 10 Tribes. Some claim the American Indians were members of the Lost 10 Tribes. Some say the Vikings. You know, there's all sorts of mysteries about the Lost 10 Tribes. Now, that would suggest that if the Lost 10 Tribes never really rejoined the Jewish people, that would suggest that every one of us is one of three tribes: Yehuda, Binyamin, or Levi. Because okay, but even that is not true, because you have to keep in mind that even when there were two separate kingdoms, there was a certain amount of migration and immigration between the kingdoms. So you could have been a Shimon person or a Yisachar person, and for Parnassah reasons, or your wife's family, or whatever it is, you actually lived in the southern kingdom. So as a result, it is entirely possible, we have no way of knowing, that any given Jew today can be a member of any one of the 12 tribes. Because even if the Lost 10 tribes as a unit never came back, there were individuals that were intermixed. So this segregation was never a total segregation. Okay? So that's it. Yeah.
Why does God care about rules such as education or keeping trust? And he should really just care about if someone's a moral person and leads good life.
Well, first of all, it's very important to note that God tremendously cares about morality and goodness and charity and compassion. That is part of the value, and you're highlighting a very important mistake. People sometimes think that religious means kosher, Shabbos, tefillin, davening, and it does. It does mean that. But they think it doesn't really matter how I conduct my business, how I treat other people. That's a big mistake. The same way we could not talk about a religious Jew who doesn't keep Shabbos. We could say, well, how come Orthodox Jews don't keep Shabbos? That's nonsensical. Because if you don't keep Shabbos, you're not an Orthodox Jew. I would say the same thing should be said when people say, how come Orthodox Jews aren't always honest in business? My answer is, not true. If they're not honest in business, they're not an Orthodox Jew. So God absolutely cares about what you're saying. But at the same time, there is the notion that ritual laws are very important because they are the ceremonies that remind us of God. Because if we were to simply say, be a nice guy and be good to people, we might do that because it's common sense. We might do that because it's a good neighbor policy. We might do that because it gets us advantages in the world. Because if I'm nice to you, you'll be nice to me. It's good for business. And the danger of doing that without a God consciousness is that when that gets a little difficult or counterproductive, when it's easier to cheat on your taxes than be honest, if you don't believe the morality is coming from God, you're going to do shortcuts. Or, to take even a worse example, when you live in a society like Nazi Germany where it's against your self-interest to be kind and compassionate to Jews, you're going to break down as so many Gentiles did, although there were some notable exceptions. What a ritual does, like keeping kosher, davening, tefillin, it reminds me that morality is simply not a matter of common sense. Morality is not simply, you know, good relations. It is not simply social utility. And by the way, this was the position of Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, the great, again, English philosopher, who was an agnostic, basically taught that morality was a matter of self-preservation. The reason I'm not going to kill you is because if I would go around killing you, you would go around killing me, and you know, it would be a dangerous world, so I better be nice, that way you'll be nice to me. But that's expediency, that's not morality. Hobbes reduced morality to expediency. What ritual does is, it sensitizes us to a God. And that in turn redefines our moral natures as well. So in a very indirect way that you might not always notice, tefillin and davening and all of these rituals actually feed into the strength of your morality by making it independent of your personal predilections or comfort zones. Now kosher in itself, I don't know if any of you ever practiced taekwondo, but you know, you know, when my son was a child, he did taekwondo in school, you know. And, you know, taekwondo is one of these oriental, you know, martial arts things, very popular with younger children. And taekwondo has a lot of what you might call useless ceremonies. You know, you got to show respect. In fact, somebody once said that the respect and good midot, good character that they picked up in taekwondo was better than they were getting in their Jewish education, which, you know, okay, that's unfortunate, but sometimes it's even true. And a lot of it is meaningless. You know, you bow down a certain way and you have to be respectful. But it teaches a person discipline. And discipline is inherently important in life because it shows you that you don't pursue self-gratification at all costs. And that's a big lesson. When I'm hungry and I'm walking by a non-kosher restaurant, I can't go in and eat. There are things I can't do, things I can't go. Now people ask why, but in some ways, you don't even have to have a reason. It is the actual discipline itself. Like, why keep kosher? I can give you reasons. It teaches you reverence for life and the like. But one of the lessons of kosher is just say no. Meaning, it almost doesn't make a difference what God said you can't eat. It is the fact that God said you can't eat certain things that trains me in being a stronger person. And when I'm a stronger person, I can resist peer pressure. I can resist giving in to something because everybody's doing it. So rituals are lessons in moral strengthening and consistency of character and in delayed gratification and in learning to say no when you'd rather do something else. You see, so there is a relationship between ritual and morality that one should not forget. Yeah?
What's the reason that God's plan for the human race that he just do everything he wants and create?
Well, you know, the question is, what is the reason for God's plan for the human race if God could have done anything he wanted to do? You know, again, these are all, I have to admit, with my limitations, very unanswerable questions, but I will go back to the text that apparently you were learning, the Derech Hashem, the way of God, from Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, and he says the following. He says, it's a kind of a revolutionary proposition. God, in a sense, has no needs. God doesn't need anything, because God is perfect. If you have a need, that means there's something you're missing. And it's impossible to talk about God as missing anything, because then he wouldn't be perfect, right? That's our starting premise. But he then says, there is one thing God needs. God needs a capacity to bestow his goodness and his kindness on others. Because God is a giver, and the nature of God is selfless giving. But without a recipient, there is no one to whom to give. So God, out of what you might call a cosmic loneliness, created a universe and a human race and a Jewish people so they would have the opportunity to receive his goodness. Now, I fully understand that what I just said is a logical conundrum and a self-contradiction. Because if we start off with the notion that God is perfect and as a result has no needs, how can I then say in the next line that God has a need to bestow his goodness on others? Well, all I can tell you on that is that God's needs are self-imposed needs, which gets you into a mystery. Meaning, it's not an inherent need, like, I'm hungry, I can't help it, I'm hungry. You can't say God can't help it, because God could help whatever he wanted. But God willed that he should have this need. And that gets us into a real mystery. So why did God will himself to have that need instead of willing himself to have another need? I don't know. In other words, there's going to be a point at which we're going to hit a wall. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So, are you saying that God needs to create or that he wants to create?
God created through God's will. God's will was that he needs to create. Now, it is an act of will. It's not like I'm hungry. But the will is not pure will. The will took the form of generating a need. And that is described as a need of the Creator, albeit a need that he willed himself to have. So, you're getting, it gets into difficult issues. But in that sense, therefore, it is not imperfection, because the chisaron emanates from God's will, which didn't have to have that chisaron. That lack, that inadequacy, is not inherent to God. It is the will of God to have that need. Yeah?
I've got two questions. Firstly, you just said in an answer to a question over there that God, in simple terms, is lonely. He wants to create something. He willed it.
Yeah.
He created the earth.
Yes.
How can you say that? Because that sort of compares God's human beings, that gives God human emotions. And
yes. You are 100% correct, and that is, as I mentioned from Maimonides stated that we are not able to describe any inner emotional state of God. We can just describe behaviors of God. And from the behaviors, so when we see actions of goodness and benevolence, we describe God as compassionate, although intrinsically we cannot really describe an inner state. So this loneliness, so to speak, which again is a term that sounds a little sacrilegious, but I think it's a legitimate term based on Rav Luzzatto, is not describing necessarily an inherent emotional state, but it's simply saying from God's actions are consistent with the emotional state that we call needing to give. So based on the idea of the negative attributes, we are not describing emotion as much as we are describing behaviors which would be indicative of certain emotional states had they been done by a human being. But, again, I mean, your questions are all really, really, really good, and I'm sorry if I'm equivocating a little bit. But once again, as Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabaral says, if I understood God, I would be him. And since I'm not him, by definition, we're not going to understand. Even Moses, it is said there are 50 levels to the understanding of God. Moses got to 49 of them. but the 50th one, even Moshe Rabbeinu himself was unable to get. Yeah?
So second part is, I think you were referring to God as a he.
Oh, okay, yeah. It is a good question. Now, you know, in the Hebrew language, he is can refer to both genders, but you are correct. God is not masculine or feminine. God is the totality of all powers that exist in the universe, and within God, there are attributes that we identify as masculine, and there are attributes that we identify as feminine, because within God, I'm not saying God is bisexual either, God is total. And for example, the very common word Shekhinah, which is divine presence, is a feminine word. Well, based on the typology, when we refer to action that takes place in the world, that is normally associated as male, because male factually is the one that does most of the external work in the world. So when we are describing God as active in the world, it tends to be masculine. But when we describe... it is a social construct, but to some degree it may be reflective, or it is reflective, of deeper spiritual truths. You know, the modern feminist movements, and maybe its antecedents were in the 19th century suffragette movement for women's votes, but the modern feminist movement dates from around the 1960s, at least in the United States. I'm not familiar with England here. Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem, these are the gedolim of the great, all Jewish by the way, of the feminist movement. And their initial argument was that distinctions between men and women are simply cultural and social constructs. They're artificial, and the goal would be to obliterate them to whatever degree is possible. That was the theme of feminism. If you follow developments, though, we have now entered a time that sociologists call post-feminist, in which, instead of emphasizing the idea that men and women are fundamentally the same, the idea is now posited that they are fundamentally equal in terms of dignity, significance, and importance, but in point of fact, there are major differences, and one should celebrate differences and different perspectives instead of seeking conformity and sameness. The classic book in this regard, which is a very, very groundbreaking book, was A Different Voice, written by Professor Carol Gilligan, who was a professor of social psychology at Harvard University. So she was a woman and an academic, and she showed that from a very, very early age, men and women, boys and girls, the age of 5, approached the world in a very, very different way in terms of how they answered test questions, how they responded to social problems. So the insight here is that although I will agree with you that occasionally even religion has sometimes treated women in an inferior, not religion, but religious people have sometimes treated women in an inferior way, that is not the message of the Torah. The message of the Torah is there are feminine characteristics and there are masculine characteristics, and one needs to celebrate and identify unique strengths, and therefore there shouldn't be sameness and obliteration of differences. But different functions and different strengths is not a connotation of superiority and inferiority, and that would be a big mistake to take it that way. So if you study developments in feminism, particularly post-feminism, you will actually see that that is the orientation even within secular society at this point. In fact, men felt left behind because as women were celebrating the uniqueness of femininity, you know, men were just the other. So now they have men's groups where they beat drums and they do all sorts of things, and it's trying to establish what is my definition of masculinity. And this is exactly what the Torah is saying, that men should understand what it means to be men and women should be women, and then there can be mutual respect that crosses the barriers, and then relationships get stronger as well.
Just looking at it, sorry, rather. Last question.
Okay, yeah, but... Yeah.
Just start with Josh. That the biology of the creation of life is the paradigm that is used for male and female, key and lock issue.
Yeah.
That you're alluding about the fact that the action is done by the key as opposed to by the lock.
Right, the woman receives. That's a very good point. The very biology of reproduction, the woman receives that which the man deposits. Key and a lock is a good way of putting it. One more question you said? Anyone? Last question? Going once, going twice? Okay. Have a real good day. It was a pleasure meeting you, and much, much success.